And with me is film director, producer, and screenwriter Peter Bogdanovich, whose movies include The Last Picture Show, What's Up, Doc, Paper Moon, Daisy Miller, At Long Last Love, Nickelodeon, St. Jack, and his latest, They All Laughed, which opens tonight in Philadelphia. He's directed Sybil Shepherd, Ryan and Tatum O'Neill, Ellen Burstyn, Barbara Streisand, Burt Reynolds, Ben Gazzara, John Ritter, and Dorothy Stratton. His first few movies were box office hits, and they were followed by several box office flops, so he's seen both sides of the American film industry, commercial success and failure. Bogdanovich saw thousands of movies when he was young and got his start in the film industry, working on Roger Corman biker films. He's also been a film critic and has written for The Village Voice and Esquire. He's written books on directors John Ford and Fritz Lang and monographs on Alfred Hitchcock, Howard Hawks, and Orson Welles. His latest film, They All Laughed, is a romantic comedy about three men in a detective agency which specializes in tailing unfaithful spouses. Detectives start falling in love with the women they're following, and several tangled relationships form between the film's eccentric characters. It stars Ben Gazzara, Audrey Hepburn, John Ritter, and Dorothy Stratton. They All Laughed opened in a couple of cities at the end of 1981, but never received full national distribution. Bogdanovich is now distributing the film through his own company, Moon Pictures. It opens in Philadelphia tonight at the Annenberg Center at Walnut Street between 36th and 37th. There will be shows at 7:15 and 9:30 with personal appearances by Peter Bogdanovich at both of those shows. Again, that's 7:15 and 9:30. Tomorrow, the Annenberg Center will also feature screenings at both those times, although Peter Bogdanovich will not be present. Sunday, They All Laughed begins a two-week run at the TLA Roxy Screening Room, and that's at 2021 Sansom Street. So that run starts on Sunday. Peter Bogdanovich, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a great pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Terry. Thank you.
I get the feeling you grew up in movie theaters.
Well, to a degree. I mean, I grew up with radio, actually, which we're on again here. But radio and movies, those were the things I was interested in. Then radio as a dramatic medium died around the time I reached my maturity, and a little before, actually. And then movies became a dominant interest.
Did you see everything that came around, or were you a selective film goer?
No, I was pretty selective, but there was a period where I was seeing everything because I was getting into everything free. And that was from the time I was about, I don't know, 17, 18. And for a few years, I saw everything because I was also a critic at that time, so to speak. I've since then, in the recent years, I've seen very little, but I did see a lot of pictures once upon a time.
Movies have become your profession, but when you were young, spending a lot of time in movie theaters, were you discouraged? Did people tell you that it was taking away time from more serious pursuits?
Well, I wasn't that much of a, you know, I didn't go that often. It wasn't as though I haunted them and didn't go to school or anything. I'd go on the weekends, but I didn't spend that much time. My mother at one point, when I was about 13, told me that I had to go to the theater. I lived in Manhattan, and I had a big fit because I didn't want to go to the theater. I'd never been to the theater, and I wanted to just go to a movie, and so she insisted that I go to the theater. Finally, I went and was struck by it and fell madly in love with the theater when I was 13. And from the time I was 13 till I was about, in my early 20s, I was involved in the theater largely. I went to the movies, but I was working in the theater. And directed my first play in New York when I was 20, and then did some more plays in New York between the time I was 20 and 25.
Why'd you leave theater for the movies?
Well, I think really, although I was fascinated with the theater and interested in it, I was always sort of aiming for the movies and learning about working with actors. I studied with Stella Adler for 4 years. You know, Stella worked with Marlon Brando and Bobby De Niro and a lot of people.
As a critic, you seem to have been most interested in American film directors. This was probably at a time when intellectual people were probably especially interested in European art films. Did you feel that you were out of step, or did other people feel that you were out of step in your interest in American genre directors?
Well, I've always felt a little out of step. I think if you're really in step, you're not probably necessarily an artist. I think artists need to be a little bit out of step, hopefully, because they're leading the way. And even if everybody says, well, you think everybody's out of step, but you, an artist, tends to say, I think so. But Yeah, I think that there was a period in the early 60s when, which seems like a millennium ago to most of you, because most people I meet now are young, much younger than me. And we were, Andrew Saras and Gene Archer and me and a couple other critics in America, were influenced tremendously by the French criticism that came over around the end of the 50s, written by Truffaut and Godard and so on. And they were very interested in the American directors. And what they were saying, essentially, which got garbled into the auteur theory over America, was simply that these directors were, some of them, were making very personal films under the guise of genre films. In other words, a John Ford Western was not like another person's Western. It was really a personal film dealing with his personal feelings and concerns, disguised as a Western. And when you begin to get interested in movies in that way, and that's as I did, and I became a kind of popularizer for that idea. And I think I was also probably trying to create a climate in which I could function.
I guess one of the differences between the directors from the studio period who made genre films and directors now is that, well, there's no studios, and you're not pressured to turn out a certain number of genre films per year or per decade.
Well, one of the things that's gone wrong is that the American film, despite the fact that two things happened in the last 20 years. One is that the kind of critical writing that I was doing, the kind of pictures that we were trying to popularize, the writings have been misunderstood and trivialized, so that, in fact, most people who are making films today, genre films today, are making just silly genre films that have no personality. We weren't interested in the genre. We were interested in how the genre expressed the personality, or how the artist, how the director used the genre. Either that happened, or the American filmmaker got to be very pretentious, and we have that side of the coin. So it's either very pretentious or very juvenile. And unfortunately, what we were trying to do was not accomplished. I will say that we did have a tremendous impact on critics, and today most critics don't write about William Wyler and Fred Zinnemann and George Stevens. They write about Howard Hawks and Alfred Hitchcock and John Ford, and that's a good thing, I think.
Since you had been a critic before starting to direct your own films, did you put certain pressures on yourself, since you had been used to evaluating the work of others and seeing it with a critical eye, and it's maybe a different kind of eye that you would use when you were actually immersed in your own work, when you maybe have to rely more on your own intuition as well as those film critical skills?
Well, I think, really, to tell you the truth, I don't think I was ever that hot a critic. I think I was, as Shaw called himself, a popularizer. I liked a certain director for whatever instinctive or emotional feeling that I had. Most cases, I went out and sought out these men and talked with them, and then wrote about them based on what they'd said, and often used interviews. I mean, the book I did on Ford is essentially an interview book. When I began to make pictures, yes, I think really I've always functioned on a kind of an instinctual level. And those few times when my instincts were denied, when I wasn't able to do what I felt I should do and couldn't quite explain why, I think a lot of women have that feeling, that they have an instinct for something and they don't understand why they're told that the instinct is wrong. I think an artist's basic instincts are feminine. And I've experienced this often, where I've said, I want to do something. Somebody says, why? And I say, I don't know. And I just feel I ought to do it this way. And then maybe a year or two later, when the film is completed, I can look at it and put on my objective critical hat and say, oh, well, this is why Bogdanovich did this and this and this and this. And I can understand it objectively then, but I couldn't while I was making the picture. Does that answer your question?
You got your start in film with Roger Corman, working, I guess, mostly on biker movies.
No, just one.
Oh, just one biker film?
What happened was Corman had read some of my stuff in Esquire and asked me if I wanted to write for the movies. I said, sure, and he asked me to write a script on something else. And then he was preparing a bike picture, the first bike picture since Marlon Brando's The Wild One, which, by the way, was a flop. And this was now about 14 years later, and Roger was preparing a movie which ultimately was called The Wild Angels. He asked me to work as his assistant on it, and what started to be a six-week location scouting job turned into a 22-week job, and I ended up rewriting 80% of the script, directing 3 weeks of shooting with the principals and some of the action, much of the action, and then cutting the material and learning just about everything you can about making pictures by actually doing it. The picture cost $300,000 and grossed $5 million in 1966, which was the biggest grosser Roger had ever had before or since. He recognized my contribution to it, which had been quite large, and not that I think the picture's that hot, but anyway. And then he gave me the opportunity to make my own picture, which turned out to be a little film called Targets with Boris Karloff, which was his last film and my first.
Do you consider that experience working with Corman an important one in the development of your career?
It was very, very important in terms of understanding the actual job of work that was involved. I learned how to work economically and thriftily, to put it mildly.
Is the job of making movies very different than what you had imagined as someone who watched a lot of movies?
I guess so. I think, you know, it's hard to imagine what you don't know about. Not knowing about it, I assumed the director did everything. It turns out there's an awful lot the director doesn't have to do. I've always been bossy and pushy about it and sort of wanted to do the whole thing. And consequently, the best pictures I made were the ones where it was just, you know, what I wanted to do. At least I felt that they were the best, and so did the public. The weakest ones are the ones where I was, you know, moved into doing something else. But directing, as I said we did a movie once called Nickelodeon, which was unfortunately compromised in several different areas, but it had some good things in it. And there was a line in it where somebody's learning to be a movie director, and the cameraman says to him, any jerk can direct. And everybody laughed when that line came out, but I meant it, because it's true. Any jerk can direct. It's not the most difficult job in the world. It's actually one of the easiest. A good con artist can get through years of making pictures without knowing the first thing about directing, because there's somebody on the set that can do almost everything that a director's supposed to do. I mean, there's a cameraman who'll do the camera setup. There's an editor who can tell you where to cut. There's a writer who can write it. There's actors who hopefully can play it. There's sound technicians. Everybody's there. So what does a director do finally? That's a good question. To me, what I do, you know, is I stick my hand in all those areas, but what I think is the main job a director does is create an atmosphere in which the players feel comfortable and feel that they can expose themselves without worrying about it, because they trust me enough that I'll tell them if it's not right. I think that's one of the things that directors should do, create an atmosphere. I asked John Ford about it once. He said, oh, most of the good things in pictures happen by accident. And then I repeated that remark to Orson Welles, who said, well, that's true. He says, a director is a man who presides over accidents.
Do you feel that way about your own work?
I think the best things in it, you know, happen as a combination of accidents of personality working and working right.
What's an example in one of your films of something that was not premeditated?
Well, I think, you know, the best things in the movies really are not premeditated in the sense because, well, for example, this is a big example, but a glaring example. On a picture we did in Texas called The Last Picture Show, there was a scene where Ben Johnson had to do a long monologue by a tank dam, and he's talking to a couple of kids. And we got out there to shoot it, and Ben and I had rehearsed it briefly. And I said, well, let's try it. And it was a long piece of film without any cut. And we started to shoot, and it was a kind of an overcast day. It looked like it was going to rain. And as we started to shoot this scene, suddenly the sun came out from behind a cloud, and it came out just at the time when, in the dialogue, it seemed like it would be nice if the sun came out, and it did. And I remember looking over at the cameraman, and I gestured to him like, you know, is this going to work? And he shrugged his shoulders. He didn't know. And the scene, the sun went in and the sun went out, and it was as though it was working on cue. And when it was over, you know, I said, well, you know, there's no way that we can get anything like that again. Ben was wonderful, and he and the sun won the Oscar, you know, that year. The effect was subliminal on the audience. The audience didn't say, oh, look, there's the sun coming out. But the feeling that happened was accidental. You know, nobody can plan that. You don't go around saying, well, let's try it again. Maybe the sun will do it again. That's a big example. But and also I didn't know enough. I didn't know as much when I started making pictures as I hopefully do now. And in the last couple of movies, I've tried to create more than ever an atmosphere in which accidents can happen. When I say accidents, it isn't so much that it's, you know, some big accident like the sun coming out or somebody dropping something and it's funny. It's really just a kind of a feeling that that this hasn't been rehearsed to the point where everything's down perfect. That, for example, in They All Laugh, there are many scenes that were written just before we shot them. The actors had never read the lines before. I mean, they'd just maybe gone over them two or three times, and then we shot it. This gave them a feeling of freshness. This made them feel like maybe they weren't even sure if they were saying the right words, but they were. And but it gave that kind of tension underneath the performance that made it seem fresher.
In They All Laugh, there's a lot of physical comedy. For instance, John Ritter is sitting in a hotel, and he's supposed to be not noticeable, but he's actually very nervous because he's watching someone who he's suddenly gotten this crush on. And he picks up a beverage, and the straw goes right into his nose. Mm-hmm. And he is in a roller skating rink and falls at just the wrong moment. That's planned out, isn't it?
Oh, sure. Those are physical jokes.
And how do you, as the director, go over that with someone? How do you work it till it gets right?
Well, a joke like the swizzle stick going up the nose is something that, you know, it looks easy, but it isn't that easy to get it to go up the nose so that it doesn't look like it was planned. And, you know, when you have as good an actor as John Ritter is, and there's nobody better at comedy than John, and the television stuff that he does is not an example of his best work. I put him in pictures, you know, Nickelodeon was his first picture. We worked the stuff together. You know, John is wonderful. He didn't even know how to roller skate. I said, well, you have to learn to roller skate so you can fall down, you know. And he did, and he just moves brilliantly. So you work with him, and you tell him kind of what you want to do, and he does. I tell you, I always thought directing also was showing the actors what to do, showing them, literally. In other words, if they acting it out for them, say, look, try this, and then you do this. I found that most directors don't do that. I asked Jimmy Cagney one time I met him, I said, who are the best directors you worked for? And he said, I've worked with about 80 directors, but of those 80 directors, I would say that there were only 5 that were directors. And I said, well, what do you say makes a director? He said, a director to me is a fella who, if I don't know what the hell to do, he can get up and show me. So I've always gotten up and showed the actors, and generally speaking, it helps. Lubitsch, I found out, who's probably my favorite director, certainly one of my 5 favorite directors, directed everybody by getting up and showing him what to do. I mean, whether it was a chorus girl or a maid or a butler or a king, he'd act it out. And I asked Jack Benny once, who did a picture with Lubitsch, I said, what was it like working with Lubitsch? I mean, what did he do? He says, he'd act out the whole thing for you. I said, was he any good? He said, well, he was a little broad, but you got the idea.
Do any actors dislike it when you do it for them? The way some actors really hate it if you give them a line reading.
Some actors do, but I've only had one actor that ever gave me any trouble about it. And it was one of the worst performances I've had. But he finally did what I asked him to. Because to me, a movie has similarities not only to painting but to music. And I've often said it's a little bit like visual music. And often the way a line should sound is, you know, I hear it in my head. And then often it's a question of communicating to the actor how I hear it, because if he says it differently, it doesn't sound right. Now, sometimes they'll say it the way I didn't hear it, and that's one of those things I call an accident, because it's better than what I had in mind. I don't try to force force it on the actor. I like to let the actor feel like he's kind of doing it. So I don't say, do it. I don't say, get up and say, do it just like this. I say, something like this. This is the idea. But, you know, sometimes an intonation or the rhythm of the speech in a scene is what's funny. There are scenes in What's Up, Doc, for example, that aren't all that funny in the way that if you read it. But when you see it played and you hear it, it sounds funny. If you analyze it, isn't that funny? It's the sound of it. The rhythm is funny. That's true in comedy.
Which are your favorites of the movies that you've done? Which do you think are the most successful?
Well, I don't know. You know, favorites have different reasons. You know, I have a favorite for a reason other than what you might like. But I think the two best pictures are probably, for my money, are probably The Last Picture Show and They All Laughed. I like the acting in The Last Picture Show. I like the integrity of the whole thing and the way it was done. I think it's good. It's not as smooth as some of my other pictures later, but it's got this kind of rough integrity and honesty in the performances that's very good. They All Laughed, I like for another reason. I think it's the most like me. If somebody said, what kind of movie are you good at? I'd say, well, They All Laughed is my kind of picture.
Speaking of being like you, I noticed in that the glasses John Ritter wears in the film are not unlike
the
glasses you wear.
Not only that, but the clothes are my clothes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, originally I was going to play the part. And then I wrote it for myself, and then I thought that it ought to be... Well, see, the movie that you see is not the movie that was originally written. The movie kept changing. And at a certain point, I decided that I was a little too old to play the part because I felt the character should be about 30, 31, 32. And I, at this point, was about 40. So I thought it'd be better if a younger actor, and then John, who I always felt looked a little like me, so I said, John, you're going to play me. He said, oh, that's good. And then we put my glasses on him and the jacket. And then actually I wrote it more for John once he was in it. But John and I do certain things the same way. And John has a wonderful way of playing a kind of befuddled. And I'm not necessarily befuddled, but I'm often absent-minded, which passes for befuddlement.
Yeah, I guess an ironic thing about that is the character who he falls in love with on screen is the woman who you had intended to marry before she was very tragically shot, and that's Dorothy Stratton.
Right.
Is it difficult to direct someone who you're in love with? Because you also directed Sybil Shepherd, with whom you were lovers.
Well, I tell you, I make it a point to sort of have a love affair with all the actors on a picture, whether male or female. I like it to be a very close working relationship, and I'd like to break through the barriers. It's not difficult. It's easier to work with somebody that you're close to. People say, well, you don't have enough objectivity and all that stuff. I don't believe in objectivity anyway. I think art is subjective. And the thing I like best is when the work is subjective and you feel the artist. Objective art to me is not art. With Sybil, she'd never acted before. She'd been a model, and I worked very closely with her on Last Picture Show. But I worked very closely with all the actors in that movie. And we fell in love, and then we had a relationship and made a few pictures together. I thought it was all right. We got into a bad bind with the press and the media, and that was mainly badly handled by me and Sybil, but more me because I was older and should have known better. With Dorothy, it was a whole nother thing. It was really, she inspired the final movie that you see. I think she was the key inspiration for it. I was falling in love with her as I was rewriting the script for her. Didn't really know it until we were sort of into it. And we both fell in love with each other. And Dorothy was one of the easiest people to direct, not because I was in love with her, but because she was so natural. Unlike a lot of the new people that I brought to the screen, say Tatum and O'Neill or Sybil or Madeline Kahn, or there's been a bunch. Dorothy was probably the most natural, she needed the least amount of direction. It was quite amazing because I was prepared to have to direct her at length because she'd only done a couple of things. But she had this extraordinary believability. It was impossible for her to say anything, and it didn't. It always sounded natural. Always sounded real. Sometimes it was not quite exactly what I meant, but then I would say a word, and she'd say, "Oh," and then we'd do it that way. She had some very long scenes to play with John Ritter that were without a cut. One at the Roxy at the skating rink, and then there was one down at the steps, and they were, you know, long, 3, 4, 5 pages of dialogue without a cut, and I would rehearse it with John and Dorothy. We'd go over it for maybe 15, 20 minutes, and then we'd go out and we'd shoot it, and I'd look at it the first take, and I really wouldn't know what to say because it was perfect, and I don't say that often. So I'd say, maybe I'm crazy. Maybe I like these two people too much or something. So we'd do it again, and we'd print the first two takes, and then I'd look at them, and the first one was perfect, like I thought. John, after the picture was over, said to me, I said, "You were wonderful with Dorothy." He said, "Well," he says, "all I had to do was look at her. That's all I had to do."
It's really bizarre that after doing this really lighthearted romantic comedy, that something so terrible would happen afterwards to one of the stars of the film and, you know, to the person you are in love with. Does that, you know, like the difference between film reality and reality is pretty different. And in a way, we want comedies to help remove us from the difficult things from life. But how did you feel about the film after that, since it was so different from what life really had in store for you?
Well, the movie was a fantasy. We knew when we were making the picture that it was a fantasy, in the sense that it was that we knew that life isn't the way we portrayed in the movie. New York isn't as beautiful as we make it seem. I mean, we didn't do anything particularly to jazz it up, but we just excluded the ugly. We excluded even the villains in the movie. The two villains, the two husbands in the movie, are minor characters that are kind of kept off screen pretty much. You just get the impression jealous, envious, mean-spirited, restrictive, repressive, but we don't deal with it particularly. We keep it off camera. My intention was to show that isn't it sad that life isn't like this? In other words, the happy ending with Dorothy and John and those characters, Colleen and Sean Ferrer and so on, the audience is supposed to know that this is improbable. That's why they laugh, because they say, isn't it funny? This isn't like life, but isn't it nice? The relationship between Gazzara and Hepburn ends unhappily because life does end unhappily often. So the picture has a kind of melancholy strain, because we know as we're making the picture and as you're watching it that life isn't like this. And the point is, wouldn't it be nice if it were? When the picture was over and it came 3 weeks later shatteringly apparent that life was quite different, and the offstage husband came on stage and killed his wife, it simply proved the point that life was anything but what it should be like. So it set me to, I haven't made a picture since then. I've been planning a few, and I've been writing a book about what happened, which will be published at the end of the year. And it's made me examine not only my own reasons for making pictures, but, you know, the life around me more than I ever did before. What is it really all about, Alfie? What are we making pictures for, and what is the point? I think I can make some better pictures because I've learned a few things more than I knew before about people and life. But that's what I've been doing the last 3 years, kind of going through a odyssey of my own, trying to figure out really where we are. And we're not in the best of shape in the world today, as I don't think it needs me to say.
Peter Bogdanovich is my guest. You had said before that you felt that you really worked best on your intuition, and the places where your films went wrong are places where people interfered with it. What are some examples of that outside interference?
Well, for example, a picture like Nickelodeon, which had been a pet project of mine, is a movie about the early days of pictures, which I consider to be the best days of pictures, meaning the silent period. was destroyed in the process, because what I wanted to make was a small budget, about $4 million, black and white movie with no names. Now, no names. I wanted to use John Ritter, who was not a name, to play the Ryan O'Neill part. I wanted Jeff Bridges, who was a bit of a name, to play the Burt Reynolds part. And the studio said no, they didn't want to finance a small black and white movie. They wanted a color movie with stars. And although I fought it, and in retrospect I think should not have done the picture at all, circumstances swept me along and I was stuck and made a picture that, you know, just limps along and isn't what I had in mind. It's got sort of flashes of what was meant, but it isn't the movie that was intended. And the more money you spend on a picture, that picture ended up costing twice what I wanted it to cost. And the more money you spend, the more people you have over your shoulder saying, you know, well, now you better not make this scene because people aren't going to like this character. And so you take out scenes that have an edge to them, and the picture ends up tame. That's a good example. At Long Last Love was a musical. We made an original musical. Original musicals, although we had music by Cole Porter, songs by Cole Porter, it was still an original book, you know, the musical. And when you do an original show, you know, you take it out on the road for 7 months sometimes, 6 months, then you bring it to New York. Well, we had two previews. And I said, I need more time, because the previews weren't right. And I needed more time, but the picture was set to open. And we were stuck with the opening date. And by the time the picture opened, I knew it wasn't right. But it was too late. And subsequently, I did recut the picture the way I wanted it to. And, you know, the version that now is occasionally shown on TV is the correct version. But, it was too late.
Is it a film you're satisfied with now?
No. Uh-uh. But it's better than it was when it came out. It just was never right. And it was much too ambitious. What was dismissed when people saw the picture, it was dismissed as a weak attempt to do an Astaire Rogers 30s musical, which was just the opposite of what we had in mind. The idea was to do a musical about people who sang because they didn't know how to talk. They sang a song because it was the only way that they could express what they felt, like somebody sends a greeting card that he buys, as opposed to somebody who writes his own poem. So it was about people who couldn't communicate, people who stutter. Sometimes sing in order to be able to communicate. You know, I can't sing, but I'm in the mood for love. You know, they can do that. So that was the idea. Again, I can say that now. I wasn't quite sure what I was doing when I was doing it. As it turned out, it was a story of my divorce. It was a story about two guys who were in love with two different women, and two women were in love with two different guys, and they never could kind of make it so that they were in love with the right person at the right time. Well, that's the way I noticed life was going for me, so I tried to make a comedy out of it. And it was completely misunderstood. Now, again, it was based on me, because I do that. I sing a lot. Not so much lately, but I used to sing a lot to, you know, girlfriends or just for fun. And it was a way of saying something that you couldn't necessarily come out and say normally.
You actually quote from songs a lot, both in your speech and, of course, also in the titles for your movies. Do you ever feel like you're using lyrics to help speak for you?
Well, yeah. You know, everything's been said. Ecclesiastes said there's nothing new under the sun. And I think it was Madame Pompadour's hairdresser who said, nothing is new except what is forgotten. So, you know, you look for a catchphrase because it or a line from a song or a line from a poem or something, because it speaks for you. You know, I think quotes are good things to throw in.
Do you see any connection between your interest in popular songs and American genre directors?
Well, you know, popular songs, there are good popular songs and bad ones. I think that the love ballad, so to speak, in certainly in modern times, is one of the few, the last bastions of romantic expression, particularly with modernist poetry, which started with Eliot and Pound and so on. If a person wants to hear a poem or see about love, which is what poems were supposed to be about originally, you ended up just having to listen to a popular song. And when Frank Sinatra sang How Deep Is the Ocean, you said, that's what I mean. And it was a way of for the common man to express himself, you know, because most people aren't poetic. That's why some people are poets and some people aren't.
You talked before about interference with your movies and the unhappiness with the distribution and preview process. What action are you taking now to try to become more independent from that?
Well, in the last 3 years since Dorothy was killed, I've re-examined everything that I've been doing and everything that we're doing as movie makers, and I've come up with some decisions. And we have just finished raising a lot of independent financing out of Texas and out of the Southwest because we've had a lot of interest there. So the next three pictures that we're doing, probably the next six pictures, but certainly the next three, are independently financed, and then we will make distribution deals with the major studios, with a major studio or several. But once the picture is financed independently, one has much more control, not only of course you have control of the production, how it's going to be done, but then you have more control later too, because you're bringing a product that's finished to the studio, and you have much more input. In fact, you have control because we actually own the pictures. That's what you have to have. It isn't a question of control simply on the set and in the cutting. It's also in the preparation and then in what happens when the picture comes out to the public. It's all part of the communication process. It's one thing for me to write a script and make it, but then I've also got to get it to the people. And that's where sometimes it goes wrong too, often.
Of the different aspects of filmmaking that you do yourself, screenwriting, directing, producing, which is the most enjoyable for you?
Well, I like to direct when I'm on the set. I enjoy making the picture, right? When we're making it. That's the most fun. I don't particularly like writing it, and I don't particularly like cutting it, although, you know, but I like to make the picture. I think I like acting in pictures. That's fun. That's easy compared to directing them. I think just making the picture while we're doing it is a lot of fun.
Did John Ritter stutter your movements?
A little bit.
I noticed you fixed your glasses much like he does.
There's a few things that are just like me. It always makes me laugh because I didn't know he was going to do it that way.
You don't go to movies much anymore. Why not, and do you miss it?
No, I tell you, I haven't been going much because I haven't had any time. Not so much just because I'm not interested. I just haven't had time the last few years because I've been either making them or doing something else. But I don't find the movies that interesting anymore. To me, movies were always a way, from the time I began to understand what they were all about, they've been a way of communing with, you know, somebody whose work I admired or whose point of view I was interested in. And there are less of those people around today. Most movies, I think, are pretty juvenile. It seems to me that despite the so-called adult revolution of the screen, the sexual revolution, the ability to deal with serious themes and all this that supposedly happened in the last 20 years, I really think it's been a fake... a fake maturity. It really, I think, has been a belated adolescence. And what's happened is that the movies have discovered their genitals and decided to play with them. And that's what movies have been for the last 20 years. I don't find that terribly interesting.
In Pauline Kael's review, very positive review of your movie, The Last Picture Show, she wrote that in the movie Factory Days, the studios were... They were maybe hacks there, but they knew how to make good trash. And she said that now they have hacks trying to imitate artists, and that it's really terrible. Mm-hmm. What's happening? Do you agree with that? That the hacks are trying?
Yeah.
The hacks aspire higher now and are trying to imitate artists.
That's the problem. They weren't trying to make art in the old days. They simply were making it. Not all movies were art. On the contrary. When the American movie industry made, say, 450 movies a year, law of averages was, and you had so many really talented people working, that you'd have better pictures being made. Today, there's many less pictures being made, and a lot less talented people are working.
Do you read the reviews of your films?
If they're good. If they're not, I don't. Usually somebody reads them for me because I don't. And now I've gotten to reading less and less because, I don't know, if they're good, I'm just glad that they're good. And if they're not, I don't bother reading them.
Why wouldn't you want to read the bad ones?
Well, it's depressing. Somebody is writing in print that he didn't get what you had in mind, and so you feel like, what's the point? He didn't get it.
Do you have a list of your favorite directors or favorite movies?
Well, I tell you, Terry, I'm preparing a series of books that they've asked me to do called the 14 Favorite series, and we're doing, the first two are the 14 Favorite Musicals and 14 Favorite Westerns. And, well, then there'll be a whole bunch more if anybody buys the first two. The idea is to narrow it down to what are my 14 favorite in those two genres and say why. The books are going to be very personal. I talk about, you know, when I was 10 and saw Singing in the Rain the first time, and what happened when I saw it when I was 20, and what happened when I saw it last year, and what Gene Kelly told me about it, or Stanley Donen, or whatever. So it's not like a regular movie book. It's directed to the general consumer who really doesn't care about 114 musicals, but only cares about, you know, 10 or 14. My favorite directors is a difficult question because, because it varies. But I can boil it down to a few. Certainly Howard Hawks and John Ford, Alfred Hitchcock and Orson Welles, Ernst Lubitsch and Buster Keaton. Jean Renoir is probably the greatest director that ever lived, French director. And those are about the ones, I guess.
Do you trust audience taste?
No, not necessarily. I think that the audience is sometimes very accurate in its likes and sometimes very inaccurate. I think it depends. There are movies that I love that were popular and movies I love that were unpopular. There are movies that were popular that I hate, and movies that were unpopular that I hate. So it's I don't think it's a good gauge, the public.
You were very successful at a pretty young age and had several successes and then some box office failures, and now you're kind of trying to have a more independent operation. A terrible tragedy struck your life. Have you redefined success for yourself?
That's a good question, but it gives me pause. It's like somebody once said, I must have notice of that question.
That's okay. You've got 5 seconds to think
thank
it over.
I think success is a very ambiguous word. You know, I don't know quite how to answer your question. Let me put it this way. Although They All Laughed has not been a success at the box office, because, like E.T., for example, or Star Wars, I think it's a success for me. It succeeded in what I wanted it to do as a movie. It failed to reach as big an audience as I would have liked, but the thing about a movie that's good, I think, is that it doesn't go away. It stays there. Citizen Kane was a flop when it came out, too, and now everybody says it's the best American movie ever made. You know, movies, if they're any good, have a certain life, and I think They All Laugh will be around for a while.
I hope so, and I want to thank you very, very much for talking with
us.
Thank you,
Terry.
Appreciate
thanks
the time
for the,
you spent with us.
Thanks for the question.
Peter Bogdanovich has been my guest, and his many movies include The Last Picture Show and What's Up, Doc? At Long Last Love, Paper Moon, Nickelodeon. His latest film, They All Laughed, opens tonight in Philadelphia. It first opened in just a few cities a couple of years ago. Now he's distributing it through his own company, Moon Pictures.
Just Moon Pictures.
Paper Moon? No, Moon Pictures. So it will open tonight at the Annenberg Center on Walnut Street in West Philadelphia. That's between 36th and 37th Streets. And there'll be two shows at 7:15 at 9:30. Peter Bogdanovich will speak for both shows. It will also show at 7:15 and 9:30 tomorrow night, but Peter Bogdanovich will not be there for those screenings tomorrow evening.
Then, he'll be in Los Angeles trying to get out of the flood.
Then Sunday afternoon, They All Laugh begins a two-week run at the new TLA Roxy Screening Room, and that's at 2021 Sansom Street. That's 2021 Sansom Street. So that will be 2 weeks at the TLA Roxy. Thanks again for being
Thanks
with
again,
us, and
Terry.
Good luck with
Thank
the new release of the film.
Thank you.